Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Thursday, the 10th of October. We'll have the latest on the Israeli airstrike in Beirut, which is reported to have killed around 20 people. In a separate incident, UNIFIL, a UN peacekeeping force, says two of its soldiers were injured after an Israeli tank fired on an observation tower. We'll have live debate on how the US hurricane season is being weaponized in the race to the White House. Why has Northern Rail been fining students and even taking them to court when they've mistakenly bought the wrong ticket? And for one night only, Razia Iqbal is back on The World Tonight, telling me why Han Kang, the South Korean author awarded the Nobel Prize, is the tip of a very large literary iceberg. Tonight's Israeli airstrikes pounded the Lebanese capital, not in the south, where many of the strikes have until now been targeted, but in the heart of the city. Footage shared online from one of the locations hit showed at least one collapsed building and widespread damage. People are searching the rubble in the darkness. At this time, 22 people have been killed in the strikes. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, has been to one of the hospitals where the injured are being taken. She spoke to a doctor dealing with what are now familiar injuries.
It is painful. We are on a continuous alert basis. We activate what we call our mass casualty protocols to deal with, but it's definitely taxing physically and mentally.
Doctor, could I ask, are the people you're treating civilians as far as you can see?
Every single one we received was a civilian.
And any children among them?
Yes, there were children.
Well, the explosions come after 2 days of relative quiet in Beirut itself, despite fierce fighting continuing in southern Lebanon as Israel attempts to dismantle the militia Hezbollah. Just before we came on air, I spoke to our Middle East correspondent, Anna Foster, who's in Beirut.
Sean, the plume of smoke just an hour or two ago has dissipated now, but they are still digging through the rubble very close to here tonight after these fresh Israeli airstrikes, not in the southern suburbs, which is largely emptied out now, but in a small Shia neighbourhood, which is very close to the centre of the city, very close to downtown Beirut, to the UN headquarters here. In fact, it's an area where I was just a few hours ago this afternoon, and it's not a place that people have evacuated from. It was busy. There were people going about their business. Shops were open. Men smoking shisha on the streets. It was a busy place, and actually it was dominated all the time by the low and loud buzzing of an Israeli drone in the sky ahead. And people were extremely nervous. They really were. They said that they felt that there would be a fresh strike. And not long after night fell this evening, there was. At the current death toll, Sean, from that, 22 people killed, more than 100 injured. And there wasn't an Israeli warning for that strike. Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. But for this one, there was no warning at all. It really came out of nowhere for people there.
How many buildings have been damaged or destroyed, do we think?
In this latest strike, we're looking at two different locations. Certainly it appears at least one building has completely fallen. It looks like in the other location, two apartments, sort of single apartments, have been targeted. And you can see from some of the pictures we're seeing here that, you know, the walls are gone, the fronts are gone, the windows are gone. You can sort of see this grey expanse of rubble and concrete inside. When you go further down to the southern suburbs, I mean, there are a lot of buildings now that have collapsed. And in some cases, you have these great craters where you can see several floors below ground that have been sort of scooped out and damaged. But that part of town is quite quiet now. A lot of people have left, I hear. But in these other neighbourhoods, the ones that would be considered safer neighbourhoods, there are still a lot of people around. And that, I think, is why the death toll for this particular attack that we've just seen tonight is so high.
One last question to ask you in terms of the response. What sort of ability do the Lebanese authorities have to provide rapid response to these kinds of big incidents in the heart of the capital?
They are struggling now. They do their best. And there were five hospitals actually that went on standby tonight. They have hospitals like AUB Hospital, the American University of Beirut. That is where they have a lot of the specialists. So a lot of casualties tend to be taken there. But, you know, the Lebanese medical system was struggling already. It's had burdens like the port blast, like COVID, like the pager and walkie-talkie attacks that happened a couple of weeks ago. they are under strain, not just in terms of their resources, and it's becoming harder to get resources in now because a lot of the flights have been cancelled going into and out of the airport, but a lot of their staff are displaced as well. They are tired, so the system is doing its best to cope, but it's becoming harder and harder, Sean.
Anna Foster there in Beirut just before we came on air. Well, let's stay with that question of the medical relief operation. Gabriel Carlson is the British Red Cross's representative covering Middle East and North Africa. He joins us now from Beirut. Mr. Carlson, thank you for being with us on The World Tonight. What sort of impact have these explosions made in terms of the ability of the medical teams there to respond?
Thank you, Sean. My colleagues at the Lebanese Red Cross, they responded immediately after these attacks. They were on site minutes afterwards, not only the ambulances, but also the urban search and rescue teams. They have contributed to the response and they have done a brilliant job. The ambulances kept on going until a few minutes ago, tens injured and even more, tens killed and even more injured. We are deeply concerned about the utter disregard for the protection of the civilian population and the hostilities. In general, the Lebanese Red Cross continues to do their utmost, and the British Red Cross is supporting them through the Gaza Crisis Appeal, which is contributing to scale up the response from the Lebanese Red Cross.
In practical terms, you're there in sense to act as advocates for the work that the Lebanese Red Cross is doing on the ground. Can you get more resources in? Can you get other countries to supply more resources? We were hearing from Anna Foster there that getting supplies in is proving increasingly difficult.
Sean, the resources are coming in, but the magnitude of the crisis is beyond any humanitarian organization alone or together. What we need is an international solution to this crisis. However, in the meantime, my colleagues and the volunteers are responding to the crisis 24/7 across the Lebanese territories, the south, the east, and now even in the heart of Beirut. So there is no lack of resources when it comes to the will and the human resources. What we need is the people, the international community, your listeners to answer our appeal, the Gaza Crisis Appeal, in order for us to facilitate and bring these resources so they can be utilized by the Lebanese Red Cross.
Gabriel Carlson, thank you very much for joining us. I should say that the Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, have previously described these neighborhoods as Hezbollah-affiliated, but they have not yet commented on tonight's strikes. If we get any reaction from the IDF to explain the targeting in this particular case, we will, of course, bring it to you if it comes to us before the end of the programme. And if there is more from the scene, we will update you as The World Tonight continues. Coming up later, the men accused of raping a French woman who was drugged by her husband are giving evidence at a trial in Avignon, with some alleging they were intimidated into doing it.
Il n'est pas normal, cet homme. C'est un psychopathe.
I said to myself, he's not normal. This man is a psychopath. I was terrified, naked, caught in a trap.
That's to come. But let's turn to a crisis we were talking about at the top of the programme yesterday, and that was the forthcoming Hurricane Milton, which was due to strike Florida overnight.
Floridians and rescue crews are beginning the Herculean cleanup effort after Hurricane Milton devastated that state.
But we are covering the aftermath from Hurricane Milton. It is moving out of Florida and is expected to become a tropical storm by tonight. Teams are still surveying the damage.
Not as bad as experts in the emergency services in Florida had feared, but it was still bad enough. At least 10 people died, according to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, in the tornadoes which tore through Florida as Milton made landfall in the small hours. 126 tornado warnings were issued on Wednesday, the most for a single day since 1986. With Election Day only a month away, a poor response to a major disaster by the federal government could have been a major political headache for Kamala Harris and an opportunity for Donald Trump. And in a moment, we'll be discussing how two hurricanes in 2 weeks have been politicised. But before that, let's hear from Brenda Griffiths, who's for the last 8 years been living in Sarasota, Florida, a city that took the brunt of the storm. Brenda, welcome to The World Tonight. How did the night play out for you?
Well, once Milton came ashore and spent the first hour battering us at 7:30 in the evening, which was much earlier than was anticipated here. And then the eye came over the top of us, and it was peaceful and quiet, eerily quiet, actually. Nothing moved out there. And then the back end of the storm came in, the back end of the eye, which was much more fierce than the earlier part, and that really blew around the place, and we could feel the building moving a little bit there.
You've been out to look around today as daylight came, as the storm eased. What have you seen?
I went downtown. The buildings are still intact downtown, the ones I saw on the lower parts of Main Street. There are a lot of trees uprooted, bur oaks. A lot of the palms have had their fronds completely stripped off, so they're just sticks standing up there. There's some glass lying around, but mainly it's tree debris. Trees have just been uprooted. All the branches have been taken off. It's all over the place at the moment. I saw electric poles that were taken out of the ground and are now leaning across shop buildings. Yachts, there are quite a few yachts tossed on Bayfront Park, where there's a marina there, and there's one looks as though it's nesting in a tree, a big cruising yacht. There was no flooding that I could see downtown. Sarasota didn't get the flooding that it got when Helene came in. There was slight flooding, but not as much as had been the previous one a couple of weeks ago.
Still a lot of work, though, to do, and the clear-up operation. Brenda Griffiths, thank you very much for talking to us. That's the picture in Sarasota in Florida. Let's talk about the political implications of all of this, because, mercifully, the loss of life was comparatively small. But there's no doubt that Milton, arriving just 2 weeks after Hurricane Helene, which barreled across six states in the southeast of the country and claimed more than 200 lives, put this subject right centre in the political debate. On Sunday, the weekend between the two hurricanes, Donald Trump addressed a campaign rally in Michigan.
This is the worst response in the history of hurricanes. A certain president, I will not name him, destroyed his reputation with Katrina, and this is doing even worse. She's doing worse than he did. Vote for Trump, and we will take care of the American people first. We'll take care of everything.
Well, the former president didn't limit his criticism to the federal government's response. He added this claim that money intended for emergency relief was being diverted to help migrants entering the United States illegally.
Think of it. People are dying in North Carolina. They're dying all over those five, six states. They're dying, and they're getting no help from our federal government because they have no money, because their money's been spent on people that should not be in our country.
No evidence was offered by Mr. Trump to support his claim, and it's been dismissed by the Biden administration as false. Another prominent Republican, Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, posted on social media the claim that the government can control the weather. She added, "It's ridiculous for anyone to lie and say it can't be done." Last night, President Biden confronted those claims, even as he was urging the people of Florida to take the threat of Milton seriously.
Former President Trump has led this onslaught of lies. Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true. They're saying people impacted by these storms will receive $750 in cash and no more. That is simply not true either. They're saying that money needed for these crises are being diverted to migrants. What the heck are they talking about? Stop it. It's outrageous. It's just not true.
What is true, though, is that weather events like these two hurricanes are increasingly weaponized, even as the debate underlying them, responding to climate change, seems elusive. Lisa Kaczynski is national political reporter for Politico, covering the 2024 presidential race. Ryan Williams has been in the heart of political storms as a Republican strategist. He was spokesman for Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign for the presidency. Lisa and Ryan, thanks very much for being with us on The World Tonight. Ryan Williams, first, from your point of view, having been at the sharp end of this debate, what do you think is going on? Why has the president made such a play on this? The former President Donald Trump made such a play on this issue?
Well, it's the issue that's dominating the headlines at the moment in the final weeks of the campaign. And Trump wades into every issue and tries to bend it to his advantage. Storms generally benefit an incumbent politician if they do a good job responding. It gives them an opportunity to go out there and look like they're strong leaders, to help people, sometimes in a bipartisan way, if it's in a state that's governed by a governor or members of Congress from a different party. This is different in the sense that the incumbent president is not running again, and Trump is a challenger. So he's trying to insert himself into this and say, I would do a better job than the current administration, which includes his vice president, is doing. You know, typical Trump saying things that aren't quite accurate, but he's trying to score points and dominate the conversation with a few weeks to go before Election Day.
Lisa Kaczynski at Politico, was there a degree of relief did you detect in the Biden administration, and particularly maybe in Kamala Harris's campaign team, that this seems to have passed off as a well-organized operation by both the state government and the federal government?
Well, that is what they needed it to be. In large part, and most importantly, for the folks who have been affected by these hurricanes, of course. But also politically, as you know, as Ryan mentioned, and this is a huge moment in the campaign. I mean, this is the home stretch. You have seen presidential campaigns derailed by hurricanes before. You have seen the effect of poor hurricane response on presidents' just approval ratings, let alone, campaigns or reelection campaigns. And so, yes, they very much needed this to go well. And you've seen the vice president, attempting to insert herself into a process that she is not really directly a part of. You know, this is a time when the president and FEMA administrators and people like that are in touch with states and local governments. But you are seeing the vice president take on a more active role in these briefings and a more public-facing role in this because of where we are in the campaign.
And one thinks of, obviously, Hurricane Katrina and the damage that was done to George W. Bush's image at that time, but it wasn't an election moment. Is there partly with this a case, Ryan, that perhaps it's you've got to seize any issue because nothing appears to be breaking the apparent almost a complete direct divide between the two sides in terms of their share of the potential vote?
Yeah, look, Trump swings at every pitch that's thrown to him, so this is not out of the ordinary for him to try to insert himself. Kamala Harris, as the vice president trying to insert herself into the story, is a little different. I think she made a mistake doing these outreach calls to the Republican governor of Florida. He came back and said, I'm not taking your call. You don't have any role in this. You're making it up. You never called before in hurricanes. You're just doing it for politics. That was, I think, a miscalculation. Of course, he did speak to Biden, the incumbent president. And Biden actually praised DeSantis for doing a good job and keeping in touch with him. But look, any advantage in these final weeks matters. The polls are, essentially this race is tied, and it could go either way. Yeah. So every candidate's trying to find a way to take advantage of what's happening.
Lisa Kaczynski, one last thought, briefly, if you can. Climate change not really being mentioned. Is there a fear about what effect that might have on undecided, independent-leaning voters?
It is actually very interesting in how it is not really been a factor in this presidential race, no matter who has been, especially with the switch on the top of the Democratic ticket. Trump has even tried to kind of call that out recently, not as connected to the hurricane. One of the big things to watch at this point is how these hurricanes, a little bit less so on the climate change factor of it, but just in voting and everything else, do affect people's ability to vote, to get to the polls, et cetera. That's something that both campaigns are really working on right now.
Lisa Kaczynski of Politico's. And Ryan there, thank you both very much for being with us. Ryan Williams, former spokesman for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. Now, a story that we have been following on this programme and will continue to follow is the proposal to legalise some form of assisted dying. A bill supporting that idea is set to be introduced to Parliament next week by the MP Kim Ledbetter. It's expected that the bill will receive parliamentary time before the end of the year. It's a story, as I say, we followed on The World Tonight, and one that, because of the potential enormous change in how we in this country think about life and death, we're sure you want to talk about as well. With that in mind, we've been asking listeners to get in touch if you have thoughts to share or indeed experiences of your own. One listener who's already done that asked us not to identify him on air, but wanted to share his experience. One of our team has recorded his story.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had with my mother some years back. It concerned my paternal grandfather. It went something like this. My granddad was a lifelong smoker of pipe tobacco, and he was bedridden and in a very poorly state, suffering from throat cancer. One day, the doctor visited him. When he came downstairs afterwards, he said to my Nana, "I've given him an injection. He won't wake up again now." My Nana told my dad, who told my mum, who told her mother, who said, "I don't think you should tell anyone about this." That's it. The interesting thing is that the doctor freely told my Nana what he'd done. To me, this suggests that the use of such injections was, to some extent, a norm at the time. This was 1952-53. Whether the norm for Tunbridge, the southeast, or the whole country, I can only guess. It also begs the question that if it was a norm, when did it stop?
Yes, it does indeed. That is an interesting question, one to ponder. And if you have any thoughts about the debate over assisted dying as it unfolds, then do get in touch. You can talk to us on email, world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. Otherwise, on WhatsApp, the number is 03700 100 444 or via text on 84844. Give you those numbers again and the email address, world.tonight@bbc.co.uk. WhatsApp 03700 100 444 or just text 84844. And don't forget, of course, that some charges from network providers will apply in the case of both the text although I think the WhatsApp number is free, and I'll be corrected if I'm wrong about that. Now, let's talk about a story closer to home, and that is one about the pricing of rail tickets. On Tuesday, Sam Williamson posted on social media about his experience after mistakenly buying the wrong ticket to use with his rail card on a train service operated by Northern Rail and finding himself facing the possibility of court, conviction and a criminal record. He's been telling the world tonight what happened.
I got on a train at about 7:20 in the morning, and that morning I'd bought a ticket through the Northern app that had a rail card discount and said it was an anytime single. I bought this, which officially corresponding to a later service, but again, I thought it was an anytime single, so I should be able to use any train. However, I boarded this, and then I got to a ticket inspection, and then the inspector informed me that my rail card was not in fact valid for this service. Immediately, of course, I said, "I'm so sorry, this is an innocent mistake. Can I pay the difference or buy a new ticket right here and now? Or, you know, if absolutely necessary, pay a penalty fare." But unfortunately, he told me that he had no other choice but to file a travel incident report, and then Northern would contact me and may choose to pursue prosecution. And a couple of days back, I got a letter in the post from Northern saying basically to explain myself to their debt recovery and prosecutions unit, otherwise they would definitely be proceeding with legal action, which is kind of a scary thing over what was ultimately less than a £2 difference in fare.
So the difference between the ticket you bought and the ticket you should have bought was £2 or less?
I should have bought a ticket that was £5.50, and I think I paid £3.60 for my ticket. I now may be on the hook for potentially hundreds in fines, as some other people have been.
How does that feel?
It feels like this is an understandable and entirely innocent mistake, which is now being blown into something that could cost me hundreds, could result in me getting a criminal record over something that I tried amicably to solve. Yeah, it doesn't feel great.
Northern Rail would say, I think, and has said, that most of its customers, I think he says about 96% of its customers, buy the correct ticket. Others listening might say it's up to you as a passenger to check what the rules are. What would you say to those criticisms?
In regards to the criticism about not reading the T's and C's, I think when they're so obscure, for example, no one would probably figure out unless they're explicitly told, and the rail card T's and C's are not very well advertised, in my opinion.
Sam Williamson, of course, the T's and C's are the terms and conditions. It is a bit complicated, but in essence, the problem is this. The rail card discount cannot be used with any time or off-peak tickets if the ticket costs less than £12 and the journey starts before 10 a.m, except that is in July and August. Don't ask. Keris Piper, who is 23, also has a young person's rail card, was, like Sam, reported by the ticket inspector to Northern Rail's revenue team. And as she's been telling me, it's ended up being a very expensive journey.
I was on my way to work and I had a 16 to 25 rail card, which was very much in date as well. I handed it to the lady who works at the station to get a return ticket. She said, yeah, that's fine. I got on the train and then I was told it was invalid. I wasn't given an opportunity to pay the difference or to buy another ticket.
And then what happened after that?
Eventually, I was sent a letter saying, basically, there's a settlement of £135 plus the ticket fee, or plead not guilty and go to court. So I filled in the letters and I stated on the piece of paper, like it asked me to, why I wasn't guilty, sent it off. And instead, I was sent a fine of £462 whatever. And if I didn't pay it within about 10 days, there was a threat of my possible arrest. And that they would seize items. And apparently I've been convicted for it, which I didn't know about.
So the case went to court, but you weren't aware of it?
Apparently I was absent from court. I was told that they sent me a date on the settlement. If you're pleading not guilty, ignore the date and we'll send a fresh one. So I sent the letter and I never got that date. So I was apparently convicted and I've never committed a crime.
Caris Piper with the issues being raised in the Commons by Iqbal Mohammed, the independent MP for Dewsbury and Batley. Mr. Mohammed, thank you for joining us on The World Tonight. What are you hoping that the Department of Transport will say when the questions you've submitted are answered?
Good evening. Thanks for having me on. The stories that you've your listeners have just heard are absolutely, you know, they're mind-boggling. There is clear rules, but the rules are not clearly communicated. People are buying tickets at the ticket office, and even the ticket office staff seemed not to be aware of the rules. And how can somebody who's bought a ticket at a ticket office be penalised for underpaying or using their rail card at the wrong time?
Do you have any suspicion that maybe this is a form of revenue raising?
I don't have any evidence, so I can't really comment on the reasons behind this rule being in place, or why it's been in place, or why it's been so sort of aggressively followed up with passengers who have clearly made a genuine mistake. They are not aware of the rule. Even the Northern Rail app, when you buy the ticket anytime, doesn't have a banner or something really prominent to say, by the way, you can't use this before 10 o'clock.
Mr. Mohammed, we're going to have to leave it there. Iqbal Mohammed, the independent MP for Dewsbury and Batley. And it's interesting that transport questions is in the House of Commons tomorrow afternoon. So although these questions are up for written answer next week, it's possible that the issue could be raised directly with ministers tomorrow. We will, of course, follow that up on The World Tonight if that's the case. Now, let us move on and talk about a very distressing story. And it is very distressing. A court case which has gripped France for weeks. It's left many appalled that a husband could drug his wife and procure her rape by dozens of other men. The decision of Gisèle Pelicot to waive her right to anonymity has evoked enormous respect. But by that act, she's confronted both the men accused and France more generally. Not an unknown victim, in inverted commas, but a wife, a mother, a grandmother, a human being like any other. As are the men on trial, though many continue to insist they did not believe what they did was rape. But in court, they are being confronted with explicit video footage recorded at the time by Gisèle's now former husband, Dominique. Andrew Harding has been speaking to one of the accused in Avignon.
She's getting used to the daily applause now. Gisèle Pelicot arriving in court as usual, cheered by members of the public. The rape victim who refuses to be shamed, a symbol in France and beyond of defiance. But today, the focus is not on her or her ex-husband, who's admitted to drugging and raping her for years. Instead, this extraordinary trial is now focusing on the 50 other men, some out on bail, faces hidden under masks and hoods, men who are accused of raping Pelicot as she lay unconscious in her own bed. In court, each man, in turn, has been confronted with footage of what they did, including video showing Pelicot snoring as she's assaulted. We've just been shown yet more videos filmed by Dominique Pelicot over the years inside the couple's bedroom. They are shocking. I'm not going to go into details of what we saw, but clearly the prosecution believes that this is
overwhelming evidence that those men who came into that bedroom must have known that Gisèle Pellico was unconscious, that she could not have consented to what happened to her. But most of these accused men insist they are not rapists, that they genuinely believed that they were taking part in some sort of consensual sex game with the couple. Paul Roger Gontard is a lawyer defending one of the accused.
Gisèle Pellico is a victim. We are sure about that. A victim of her husband, a victim of other guys. But we are not sure she's a victim of all the guys.
Some of those on trial say they were tricked by Dominic Pellico, intimidated by him. At his house on the edge of Avignon, we spoke to one such man and agreed to keep his identity hidden since the trial is still ongoing.
Et là, je me suis dit, il n'est pas normal, cet homme. C'est un psychopathe.
I said to myself, he's not normal. This man is a psychopath. I was terrified, naked, caught in a trap.
Is there not within you any shred of feeling of responsibility for what you did?
Ça m'a transformé, cette affaire.
But the man offered no real answer, insisting he was simply a victim.
Jamais.
Which helps explain the frustration of so many still queuing to watch this trial every day, inspired by Gisèle Pellico's courage, but worried too that some of the accused may be hunting for excuses for the inexcusable.
Andrew Harding reporting. Just to return to the Northern Rail story, a Northern spokesman has told us tens of millions of passengers travel with us every year to destinations across the north of England, and we are committed to providing them with the right tickets at the right prices. We will work with the industry and the Department for Transport with the aim of simplifying ticketing for customers. We'll keep you up to date on that story. Now, this year's Nobel Prize for Literature has been won by the novelist Han Kang, the first South Korean to be honoured. Her book, The Vegetarian, first brought her to the attention of a mass audience in the West. It was an international bestseller and won the International Man Booker Prize in 2016. At the time, she spoke to our former World Tonight colleague, presenter Razia Iqbal, who is a Han Kang fan. And Razia, now Professor Iqbal, as she's become, has been telling me about how big a deal the prize is.
This is enormously significant. This win for Han Kang will not only bring new readers to her work, but also to, I suppose, the variety of literature from South Korea. And for those who know nothing about her, she is young to have won the Nobel Prize. She's 54. She was born in Gwangju in the southwest of the country, moved to Seoul when she was just 9. And her life, I think, was pretty transitory, which did concern her. The family struggled financially. She always maintained that it was reading and books that sustained her where there was a lack of stability in her family life. And the Nobel citation speaks about her writing quite directly. Poetic prose, they said, that confronts historical traumas. And this is really important in the case of Han Kang because she tackled what are known as the Gwangju massacres in her novel Human Acts. So for those who don't know anything about the Gwangju massacres, May the 18th, 1980, student-led demonstrations that were held in response to a coup. And the uprising was then violently suppressed by the army. And people say between 600 to maybe 2,300 people were killed. Deeply traumatic incident in the recent history of South Korea. I spoke to Han Kang a few years ago, and I asked her specifically about those uprisings and the massacres and how they had impacted on her.
I was born in Gwangju and I moved to Seoul when I was 9 years old with my family. And accidentally, I saw a photo book which was circulated secretly to bear witness. And I was 12 years old then, and I had to see all the gruesome faces then killed. And then I had to see the endless line of very ordinary people who wanted to donate their blood for the wounded after the mass shooting. And it was like I had to carry these two unsolvable questions about humanity, I mean human violence, and then the possibility of dignity.
It's fascinating to hear that interview. Is she a political writer, would you say?
You know, I think many, many writers would argue that the very act of writing is a political act. But of course, she is, even if you were to look only at that one novel, Human Acts. I think the central issue for her, which she also expresses so beautifully in that response in her writing life, is how can human beings be so violent and how can they be so sublime? And many people in the English-speaking world will be familiar with her one novel that has been translated into English, The Vegetarian. It's a really odd novel. Many people have not been able to finish it. It opens with this rather innocuous line. Before my wife turned vegetarian, I thought of her as completely unremarkable in every way. And then the novel moves into this area of deep, disturbing mental instability. The vegetarian wife stops eating altogether. It is transgressive. But as writing, it is thrilling. It is absolutely thrilling. It also speaks to the Nobel citation, the other part of it, which talks about her writing embracing the fragility of human life.
Human beings are so strange, you know. They can perpetrate so many horrible things like they did in Auschwitz. And human beings are creatures who could sacrifice their lives to rescue a child who has fallen into the subway track. And I always wanted to know what human is, and that fundamental question has been very important for me.
When you listen to her voice, and we can hear it in both of those extracts from that interview, she is softly spoken, deeply, deeply thoughtful woman. And I think one of the things that I have thought about today when I first heard that she had won, I mean, first of all, I jumped up with joy because I think this is so well deserved. I think she's a fabulous writer. But I also think that one of the things that happens with the Nobel Prize, you know, it comes with a very, very big check. And the thing about that is that it allows writers to have the comfort of not having to worry about how to live. So I think in her case, given the kind of peripatetic life that she had and one that did involve kind of financial struggle, this will be just such a boon for her. And, you know, so wonderful for her, but wonderful for us too. It makes me so happy to think that this win will result in hundreds, thousands, I hope millions of people interested in literature to just walk into a bookstore and ask for the work of Han Kang.
That's Professor Razia Iqbal on this year's Literature Laureate. That's The World Tonight. I'm Sean Lay. Good night.
The studio engineers were Holly Palmer and Tom Bartlett. Tonight's editor, Matthew Symington.